and he worried about her because of it. He watched how she rendered judgment upon the nobles who had worked with Galbatorix, willingly or not, and he approved of the fairness and mercy she displayed, as well as the punishments she meted out when necessary. Most she stripped of their lands, titles, and the better portion of their ill-gotten wealth, but she did not have them executed, for which Aragorn was glad. He stood by her side when she granted Nar-Garjvog and his people vast swathes of land along the northern coast of the Spine, as well as along the fertile plains between Lake Flam and the Tork River, where few, if any, people now lived. And that, too, Aragorn approved of. Like King Orin and Lord Ristart, Nar-Garjvog had sworn fealty to Nasawada as his High Queen. However, the huge Kull said,
"My people agree with this, Lady Nightstalker, but they have thick blood and short memories, and words will not bind them forever."
In a cold voice, Nasawada replied, "Do you mean to say your people will break the peace? Am I to understand our races will once again be enemies?"
"No,"
said Garjvag, and shook his massive head.
"We do not want to fight you. We know that Fire Sword would kill us. But when our young ones have grown, they will want battles in which to prove themselves. If there are no battles, then they will start them. I am sorry, Nightstalker, but we cannot change what we are."
The exchange troubled Aragorn, and Nasawada as well, and he spent several nights thinking about the Urgals, trying to solve the problem they presented. As the weeks rolled by, Nasawada continued to send him and Saphira to various locations within Cirda and her kingdom, often using them as her personal representative to King Orin, Lord Ristart, and the other nobles and groups of soldiers throughout the land. Wherever they went, they searched for a place that could serve as a home for the Eldunari in the centuries to come, and as nesting and proving grounds for the dragons hidden on Vroengard. There were areas of the Spine that showed promise, but most were too close to humans or Urgals, or else were so far north. Aragorn thought it would be miserable to live there year-round. Besides, Murtagh and Thorn had gone north, and Aragorn and Saphira did not want to cause them additional difficulty. The Beorn Mountains would have been perfect, but it seemed doubtful that the dwarves would welcome hundreds of ravenous dragons hatching within the bounds of their realm. No matter where they went in the Beors, they would still be a short flight from at least one dwarven city, and it would not do if a young dragon were to start raiding the dwarves' flock of Feldunost, which, knowing Saphira, Aragorn deemed more than likely. The elves would, he thought, have no objection to the dragons living on or around one of the mountains in Dueldenvarden, but Aragorn still worried about their nearness to the elven cities. Also, he disliked the idea of placing the dragons and the Eldunari within the territory of any one race. Doing so would give the appearance that they were lending support to that race in particular. The riders of the past had never done that, nor, Aragorn believed, should the riders of the future. The only location that was far enough away from every town and city, and that no race had yet claimed, was the ancestral home of the dragons, the heart of the Haderach Desert, where stood Dufell's Nangoroth, the Blasted Mountains. It would, Aragorn was sure, be a fine place to raise hatchlings. However, it had three drawbacks. First, they would not be able to find enough food in the desert to feed the young dragons. Saphira would have to spend most of her time carrying deer and other wild animals to the mountains. And of course, once the hatchlings grew larger, they would have to start flying out on their own, which would take them close to the lands of either the humans, the elves, or the dwarves. Second, everyone who had travelled widely, and many who had not, knew where the mountains were. And third, it was not unduly difficult to reach the mountains, especially in the winter. The last two points concerned Aragorn the most, and made him wonder how well they would be able to protect the eggs, the hatchlings, and the Eldunari. "It would be better if we were high up on one of the peaks in the Beors, where only a dragon could fly," he said to Saphira. "Then no one would be able to sneak up on us. no one except for Thorn, Murtagh, or some other magician.
Some other magician? Like every elf in the land? Besides, it would be cold all the time.
I thought you didn't mind the cold.
I don't. But I don't want to live in the snow year-round either. Sand is better for your scales, Glader told me. It helps polish them and keep them clean.
Day by day, the weather grew colder. Trees shed their leaves, flocks of birds flew south for the year, and winter thus came upon the land. It was a cruel, harsh winter, and for a long while it felt as if the whole of Alagazia was locked in slumber. At the first fall of snow, Oric and his army returned to the Beor Mountains. All of the elves who were still in Illyria, save Vanner and Blodgarm and his 10 spellcasters, likewise left for Duweldenvarden. The Urgals had departed weeks earlier. Last to go were the Weircats. They seemed to simply disappear. No one saw them leave, and yet one day they were all gone, except for a large, fat Weircat by the name of Yellow Eyes, who sat on the padded cushion next to Nasawada, purring, napping, and listening to everything that went on in the throne room. Without the elves and the dwarves, the city felt depressingly empty to Aragorn as he walked along the streets, ragged flakes of snow drifting sideways underneath the shelf of creviced stone overhead. And still Nasawada continued to dispatch him and Saphira upon missions. But never did she send them to Duweldenvarden, the one place Aragorn wanted to go. They had had no word from the elves as to who had been chosen as Islanzadi's successor. And when asked, Vanner would only say, "We are not a hasty people, and for us appointing a new monarch is a difficult, complicated process. As soon as I learn what our councils have decided, I will tell you." It had been so long since Aragorn had seen or heard from Arya, he considered using the name of the ancient language to bypass the wards around Duweldenvarden, so that he could communicate with, or at least scry her. However, he knew the elves would not look kindly on the intrusion, and he feared Arya would not appreciate him contacting her in that way, without a pressing need. Therefore, he instead wrote her a short letter, asking after her, and telling her some of what he and Saphira had been doing. He gave the letter to Vanner, and Vanner promised that he would have it sent to Arya at once. Aragorn was sure that Vanner kept his word, for they had been speaking in the ancient language, but he received no response from Arya. And as the moons waxed and waned, he began to think that for some unknown reason, she had decided to end their friendship. The thought hurt him terribly, and it caused him to concentrate on the work Nasawada gave him with even greater intensity, hoping to forget his misery. In the deepest part of winter, when sword-like icicles hung from the shelf above Illyria and deep drifts of snow lay upon the surrounding landscape, when the roads were nearly impassable and the fare at their tables had grown lean, 3 attempts were made on Nasawada's life, as Murtagh had warned might happen. The attempts were clever and well thought out, and the third one, which involved a net full of stones falling on Nasawada, nearly succeeded. But with Aragorn's wards and Elva to protect her, Nasawada survived, although the last attack cost her several broken bones. During the third attempt, Aragorn and the Nighthawks managed to kill 2 of Nasawada's attackers, the exact number of which remained a mystery, but the rest escaped. Aragorn and Jormungandr went to extraordinary lengths to ensure Nasawada's safety after that. They increased the number of her guards once again, and wherever she went, at least 3 spellcasters accompanied her. Nasawada herself grew ever more wary, and Aragorn saw in her a certain hardness that had not been apparent before. There were no more attacks upon Nasawada's person, but a month after winter broke and the roads were again clear, a displaced earl by the name of Hamlin, who had gathered up several hundred of the Empire's former soldiers, started launching raids against Gilead and attacking the travellers on the roads thereabouts. At the same time, another slightly larger rebellion began to brew in the south, led by Tharos the Quick of Aros. The uprisings were more of a nuisance than anything, but they still took several months to quell, and they resulted in a number of unexpectedly savage fights, although Aragorn and Saphira attempted to settle matters peacefully whenever they could. After the battles they had already participated in, neither of them was thirsty for more blood. Soon after the end of the uprisings, Katrina gave birth to a large, healthy girl, with a lock of red hair atop her head, the same as her mother. The girl bawled louder than any infant Aragorn had ever heard, and she had a grip like iron. Rohan and Katrina named her Ysmira, after Katrina's mother, and whenever they looked at her, the joy in their faces made Aragorn grin as well. The day after Ysmira's birth, Nasawada summoned Rohan to her throne room and surprised him by granting him the title of Earl, along with the whole of Palancar Valley as his domain. "As long as you and your descendants remain fit to rule, the valley shall be yours," she said. Rohan bowed and said, "Thank you, Your Majesty." The gift Aragorn could see meant almost as much to Rohan as had the birth of his daughter, for after his family, the thing Rohan prized most was his home. Nasawada also tried to give Aragorn various titles and lands, but he refused them, saying, "It is enough to be a rider. I need nothing more." A few days later, Aragorn was standing with Nasawada in her study, examining a map of Alagaesia and discussing matters of concern throughout the land, when she said, "Now that things are somewhat more settled, I think it's time to address the role of magicians within Cirda, Tirm, and my own kingdom." "Oh?" "Yes. I've spent a great deal of time thinking about it, and have reached a decision. I have decided to form a group, much like the Riders, but for magicians alone."
"And what will this group do?"
Nasawada picked up a quill from her desk and rolled it between her fingers.
"Again, much the same as the Riders. Travel through the land, keep the peace, resolve disputes of law, and most important, watch over their fellow spellcasters, so as to ensure they do not use their ability for ill."
Aragorn frowned slightly.
"Why not just leave that to the Riders?"
"Because it will be years before we have more of them, and even then there won't be enough to mind every petty conjurer and hedge witch. You still haven't found a place to raise the dragons, have you?"
Aragorn shook his head.
Both he and Saphira had been feeling increasingly impatient, but as of yet, they and the Eldunari had been unable to agree upon a location. It was becoming a sore point between them, for the infant dragons needed to hatch as soon as possible.
"I thought not. We have to do this, Aragorn, and we cannot afford to wait. Look at the havoc Galbatorix wrought. Magicians are the most dangerous creatures in this world, even more dangerous than dragons, and they have to be held accountable. If not, we'll always be at their mercy."
"Do you really believe you will be able to recruit enough magicians to watch over all of the other spellcasters, here and in Cirda?"
"I think so, if you ask them to join. Which is one of the reasons I want you to lead this group."
"Me?"
She nodded.
"Who else?
Triana? I don't fully trust her, nor does she have the strength needed. An elf? No. It has to be one of our own. You know the name of the ancient language. You're a rider. And you have the wisdom and authority of the dragons behind you. I cannot think of a better person to lead the spellcasters. I've spoken to Orin about this, and he agrees."
"I can't imagine the idea pleases him."
"No. But he understands that it is necessary."
"Is it?" Aragorn picked at the edge of her desk, troubled. "How do you intend to keep watch over the magicians who don't belong to this group?
I hoped you might have some suggestions. I thought perhaps with spells and scrying mirrors, so that we could track their whereabouts and supervise their use of magic, lest they use it to better themselves at the expense of others."
"And if they do?"
"Then we see to it that they make amends for their crime, and we have them swear in the ancient language to give up the use of magic. Oaths in the ancient language won't necessarily stop anyone from using magic. I know, but it's the best we can do. He nodded. And what if a spellcaster refuses to be watched? What then? I can't imagine very many would agree to be spied upon. A sigh escaped Nasawada, and she put down her quill. There's the difficult part. What would you do, Aragorn, if you were in my place? None of the solutions he thought of were very palatable. I don't know. Her expression grew sad. Nor do I. This is a difficult, painful, messy problem. And no matter what I choose, someone will end up hurt. If I do nothing, the magicians will remain free to manipulate others with their spells. If I force them to submit to oversight, many will hate me for it. However, I think you will agree with me that it is better to protect the majority of my subjects at the expense of a few. I don't like it, he murmured. I don't like it either. You're talking about binding every human spellcaster to your will, regardless of who they are. She did not blink. For the good of the many. What about people who can only hear thoughts and nothing more? That's a form of magic as well. Them too. The potential for them to abuse their power is still too great. Nasawada sighed then. I know this isn't easy, Aragorn. But easy or not, it's something we have to address. Galbatorix was mad and evil, but he was right about one thing. The magicians need to be reined in. But not as Galbatorix intended. Something needs to be done, though. And I think my plan is the best solution possible. If you can think of another better way to enforce the rule of law among spellcasters, I would be delighted. Otherwise, this is the only path available to us, and I need your help to do it. So will you accept charge of this group, for the good of the country, and the good of our race as a whole? Aragorn was slow to answer. At last he said, If you don't mind, I'd like to think about it for a while, and I need to consult with Saphira. Of course. But don't think for too long, Aragorn. Preparations are already underway, and you will soon be needed. Afterward, Aragorn did not return directly to Saphira, but wandered through the streets of Illyria, ignoring the bows and the greetings from the people he passed. He felt uneasy, both with Nasawada's proposal and with life in general. He and Saphira had been idling for too long. The time had come for a change. And circumstances would no longer allow them to wait. They had to decide what they were going to do, and whatever they chose, it would affect the rest of their lives. He spent several hours walking and thinking, mainly about his ties and obligations. In late afternoon, he made his way back to Saphira, and without speaking, climbed onto her back. She leaped out of the courtyard of the hall and flew high above Illyria, high enough that they could see for hundreds of miles in every direction. There she stayed, circling. They spoke without words, exchanging their mind states. Saphira shared many of his concerns, but she was not as worried as he about their bonds with others. Nothing was as important to her as protecting the eggs and the Eldunari, and doing what was right for him and her. Yet Aragorn knew they could not just ignore the effects their choices would have, both political and personal. Finally, he said, What should we do? Saphira dipped as the wind underneath her wings slowed.
What we need to do, as has always been the case.
She said nothing more, but turned then and began to descend toward the city. Aragorn appreciated her silence. The decision would be harder for him to make than for her, and he needed to think about it on his own. When they landed in the courtyard, Saphira nudged him with her snout and said,
If you need to talk, I'll be here.
He smiled and rubbed the side of her neck, and then slowly walked to his rooms while staring at the floor. That night,
when the waxing moon had just appeared beneath the edge of the cliff over Illyria, and Aragorn was sitting against the end of his bed, reading a book about the saddle-making techniques of the early riders. A flicker by the edge of his sight, like the flapping of a drape, caught his attention. He sprang to his feet, drawing Brisinger from its sheath. Then, in his open window, he saw a small three-masted ship woven from stalks of grass. He smiled and sheathed his sword. He held out his hand, and the ship sailed across the room and landed upon his palm, where it listed to one side. The ship was different from the one Arya had made during their travels together in the Empire, after he and Roran rescued Katrina from Helgrind. It had more masts, and it also had sails fashioned from the blades of grass. Though the grass was limp and browning, it had not dried out entirely, which led him to think that it had been picked only a day or two earlier. Tied to the middle of the deck was a square of folded paper. Aragorn carefully removed it, his heart pounding, then unfolded the paper on the floor. It read, in glyphs of the ancient language,
"Aragorn, we have finally decided upon a leader, and I am on my way to Illyria to arrange an introduction with Nasuada. I would like to talk with you and Saphira first. This message should reach you 4 days before the half-moon. If you would, meet me the day after you receive it, at the easternmost point of the Rama River. Come alone, and do not tell anyone else where you are going. Arya."
Aragorn smiled without meaning to. Her timing had been perfect. The ship had arrived exactly when she intended. Then his smile faded, and he reread the letter several more times. She was hiding something, that much was obvious. But what? Why meet in secret? Maybe Arya doesn't approve of the elves' next ruler, he thought. Or maybe there's some other problem. And though Aragorn was eager to see her again, he could not forget how she had ignored him and Saphira. He supposed that from Arya's point of view the intervening months were a trifling amount of time, but he could not help feeling hurt. He waited until the first hint of sunlight appeared in the sky, then hurried down to wake Saphira and tell her the news. She was as curious as he, if not quite as excited. He saddled her, and then they left the city and set off to the northeast, having told no one of their plans, not even Gleda or the other Eldunari. Fiernan. It was early in the afternoon when they arrived at the location Arya had designated, a gentle curve in the Rama River that marked its farthest excursion eastward. Aragorn strained to look over Saphira's neck as he searched for a glimpse of anyone below. The land appeared empty, save for a herd of wild oxen. When the animals caught sight of Saphira, they fled, lowing and kicking up plumes of dust. They, and a few other smaller animals, scattered about the countryside, were the only living creatures Aragorn could sense. Disappointed, he shifted his gaze to the horizon, but saw no sign of Arya. Saphira landed on a slight rise, 50 yards from the banks of the river. She sat, and Aragorn sat with her, resting his back against her side. On the top of the rise was an outcropping of soft, slate-like rock. While they waited, Aragorn amused himself by grinding a thumb-sized flake into the shape of an arrowhead. The stone was too soft for the arrowhead to be anything other than decorative, but he enjoyed the challenge. When he was satisfied with the simple triangular point, he set it aside and began to grind a larger piece into a leaf-bladed dagger, similar to those the elves carried. They did not have to wait as long as he first thought. An hour after their arrival, Saphira lifted her head from the ground and peered across the plains in the direction of the not-so-distant Haderach Desert. Her body stiffened against his, and he felt a strange emotion within her, a sense of impending momentousness.
"Look," she said.
Keeping hold of his half-finished dagger, he clambered to his feet and peered eastward. He saw nothing but grass, dirt, and a few lone, windswept trees between them and the horizon. He broadened his area of scrutiny, but still saw nothing of interest. "What?" he started to ask, then cut himself off as he looked up. High in the eastern sky, he saw a wink of green fire like an emerald glimmering in the sun. A point of light arced through the blue mantle of the heavens, approaching at a rapid pace, bright as a star at night. Aragorn dropped the stone dagger, and without taking his eyes off the glittering spark, climbed onto Saphira's back and strapped his legs into her saddle. He wanted to ask her what she thought the point of light was, to force her to put into words what he suspected. But he could not bring himself to speak any more than she could. Saphira held her position, although she unfolded her wings, and keeping them bent nearly in half, lifted them in preparation to take off. As it grew larger, the spark proliferated, dividing into a cluster of dozens, then hundreds, then thousands of tiny points of light. After a few minutes, the true shape of it became visible, and they saw that it was a dragon. Saphira could wait no longer. She uttered a resonant trumpet, leaped off the rise, and flapped downward. Aragorn clutched the next spike in front of him as she ascended at a nearly vertical angle, desperate to intercept the other dragon as quickly as possible. Both he and she alternated between elation and a wariness born of too many battles. In their caution, it pleased them that they had the sun to their backs. Saphira continued to climb until she was slightly above the green dragon, whereupon she leveled off and concentrated upon speed. Closer, Aragorn saw that the dragon, while well-built, still had some of the gangly look of youth. His limbs had yet to acquire the stocky weight of gladers or thorns, and he was smaller than Saphira. The scales upon his sides and back were a dark forest green, while those upon his belly and the pads of his feet were lighter, with the smallest ones verging upon white. When against his body, his wings were the colour of holly leaves, but when the light shone through them, they were the colour of oak leaves in the spring. At the juncture between the dragon's neck and back was a saddle much like Saphira's, and on the saddle sat a figure that looked to be Arya, her dark hair streaming from her head. The sight filled Aragorn's heart with joy, and the emptiness he had laboured under for so long vanished like the darkness of night before the rising sun. As the dragons swooped past each other, Saphira roared, and the other dragon roared in response. They turned and began to circle as if chasing each other's tails, Saphira still slightly above the green dragon, who made no attempt to climb above her. If he had, Aragorn would have feared he was attempting to gain the advantage before attacking. He grinned and shouted into the wind. Arya shouted back and raised an arm. Then Aragorn touched her mind just to be sure, and he knew in an instant that it really was Arya, and that she and the dragon meant them no harm. He withdrew a moment later, for it would have been rude to prolong the mental contact without her consent. She would answer his questions when they spoke on the ground. Saphira and the green dragon roared again, and the green dragon lashed his whip-like tail. Then they chased each other through the air until they reached the Rama River. There Saphira took the lead and spiraled down until she landed upon the same rise where she and Aragorn had been waiting. The green dragon landed 100 feet away, settling into a low crouch while Arya freed herself from her saddle. Aragorn tore the straps off his legs and jumped to the ground, banging the sheath of Brisinger against his leg. He ran over to Arya and she to him, and they met in the middle between the two dragons, who followed at a more sedate pace, their steps weighing heavily on the ground. As he drew near, Aragorn saw that in place of the leather strip that Arya usually wore to keep her hair back, a circlet of gold rested upon her brow. In the center of the circlet, a teardrop-shaped diamond flashed, with light that came not from the sun, but from within its own depths. At her waist hung a green-hilted sword in a green sheath, which he recognized as Tamerlane, the same sword the elf lord Fiola had offered him as a replacement for Zarok, and that had once belonged to the rider Arva. However, the hilt looked different than he remembered, lighter and more graceful, and the sheath appeared narrower. It took Aragorn a moment to realize what the diadem meant. He looked at Arya with astonishment. "You?" "Me," she said, and inclined her head. "Atra esterni ono Thelduin, Aragorn. Atra du Everinio ono Varda, Arya
Drottning? It did not escape him that she had chosen to greet him first.
Drottning, she confirmed. My people chose to give me my mother's title, and I chose to accept.
Above them, Sephira and the Green Dragon brought their heads close together and sniffed one another. Sephira was taller. The Green Dragon had to stretch his neck to reach her. As much as Aragorn wanted to talk with Arya, he could not help staring at the Green Dragon.
And him?
He asked, motioning upward. Arya smiled, and then she surprised him by taking his hand and leading him forward. The Green Dragon snorted and lowered his head until it hung just above them, smoke and steam rising from the depths of his crimson nostrils.
Aragorn, she said, and she placed his hand on the dragon's warm snout. This is Fearnan. Fearnan, this is Aragorn.
Aragorn looked up into one of Fearnan's brilliant eyes. The bands of muscle within the dragon's iris were the pale green and yellow of new blades of grass.
I am glad to meet you, Aragorn friend Shadeslayer, said Fearnan.
His mental voice was deeper than Aragorn expected, deeper even than that of Thorn or Glaedah or any of the Eldunari from Rohengard.
My rider has told me much about you.
And the dragon blinked once with a small, sharp sound, like a shell bouncing against a stone. In Fearnan's wide, sunlit mind, planked as it was with transparent shadows, Aragorn could feel the dragon's excitement. Wonder swept through Aragorn, wonder that such a thing had come to pass.
I am glad to meet you as well, Fearnan Finearel. I never thought that I would live to see you hatched and free of Galbatorix's spells.
The Emerald Dragon snorted softly. He looked proud and full of energy, like a stag in fall. Then he returned his gaze to Sephira. Between the two of them, much passed. Through Sephira, Aragorn could feel the flow of thoughts, emotions, and sensations, slow at first, but then swelling into a torrent. Arya smiled slightly.
They seem to have taken to each other.
That they have. A mutual understanding guiding them. He and Arya walked out from under Sephira and Fearnan, leaving the dragons to themselves. Sephira did not sit as she normally did, but remained crouched as if she were about to spring onto a deer. Fearnan did the same. The tips of their tails twitched. Arya looked well. Better, Aragorn thought, than she had since their time together in Ellesmere. For a lack of a more suitable word, he would have said she looked happy. Neither of them spoke for a while as they watched the dragons. Then Arya turned toward him and said,
I apologize for not contacting you sooner. You must think badly of me for ignoring you and Sephira for so long, and for keeping such a secret as Fearnan.
Did you receive my letter?
I did.
To his surprise, she reached inside the front of her tunic and removed a square of battered parchment that after a few seconds he recognized.
I would have answered, but Fearnan had already hatched, and I did not want to lie to you, even by omission.
Why keep him hidden?
With so many of Galbatorix's servants still on the loose, and so few dragons remaining, I did not want to risk anyone finding out about Fearnan until he was large enough to defend himself.
Did you really think a human could have snuck into Duweldenwarden and killed him?
Stranger things have happened. With the dragons yet on the brink of extinction, it was not a risk worth taking. If I could, I would keep Fearnan in Duweldenwarden for the next 10 years, until he is so large that none would dare attack him. But he wished to leave, and I could not deny him. Besides, the time has come for me to meet with Nasawada and Oryk in my new role.
Aragorn could feel Fearnan showing and telling Sephira about the first time he caught a deer in the Ulls Forest. He knew that Arya was aware of the exchange as well, for he saw her lip twitch in response to an image of Fearnan hopping in pursuit of a startled doe after he tripped over a branch.
And how long have you been queen? Since a month after my return. Vanna doesn't know, however. I ordered the information kept from him and our ambassador to the dwarves, so that I could concentrate on raising Fionnuala without having to worry about the affairs of state that otherwise would have fallen to me. You might like to know, I raised him on the crags of Telnair, where Oromis lived with Gleda. It seemed only right.
Silence fell between them. Then Aragorn gestured at Arya's diadem and at Fionnuala and said, "How did all of this happen?" She smiled.
"On our return to Ellesmere, I noticed that Fionnuala was beginning to stir within his shell, but I thought nothing of it, as Saphira had often done the same. However, once we reached Duweldenvarden and passed through its wards, he hatched. It was nearly evening, and I was carrying his egg in my lap, as I used to carry Saphira's, and I was speaking to him, telling him of the world, and reassuring him that he was safe. And then I felt the egg shake, and—"
She shivered and tossed her hair, a bright film of tears in her eyes.
"The bond is everything I imagined it to be. When we touched, I always wanted to be a dragon rider, Aragorn, so that I could protect my people and avenge my father's death at the hands of Galbatorix and the Forsworn. But until I saw the first crack appear in Fionnuala's egg, I never allowed myself to believe that it might actually come to pass. When you touched, did—"
"Yes." She lifted her left hand and showed him the silvery mark on the palm, the same as his own, Gedwe Ignazia.
"It felt like—"
She paused, searching for the words.
"Like ice-cold water that tingled and snapped," he suggested. "Exactly like that."
Without seeming to notice, she crossed her arms as if chilled.
"So you returned to Ellesmere," said Aragorn.
Now Saphira was telling Fionnuala about when she and Aragorn swam in Leona Lake while travelling to Dras Leona with Brom.
"So we returned to Ellesmere."
"And you went to live on the crags of Telnir.
But why become queen when you were already a rider?" "It was not my idea. Dathadur and the other elders of our race came to the house on the crags, and they asked me to take up my mother's mantle. I refused, but they returned the next day, and the day after that, and every day for a week, and each time with new arguments for why I should accept the crown. In the end, they convinced me that it would be best for our people."
"Why you, though? Was it because you are Islanzadi's daughter? Or was it because you had become a rider?"
"It was not just because Islanzadi was my mother, although that was part of it. Nor was it just because I was a rider. Our politics are far more complicated than those of the humans or the dwarves, and choosing a new monarch is never easy. It involves obtaining consent from dozens of houses and families, as well as several of the older members of our race, and every choice they make is part of a subtle game that we have been playing amongst ourselves for thousands of years. There were many reasons why they wanted me to become queen, not all of them obvious."
Aragorn shifted, glancing between Saphira and Arya, unable to reconcile himself to Arya's decision.
"How can you be a rider as well as a queen?" he asked. "The riders aren't supposed to support any one race above the others. It would be impossible for the other peoples of Alagazia to trust us if we did. And how can you help rebuild our order and raise the next generation of dragons if you're busy with your responsibilities in Ellesmere?" "The world is not as it used to be," she said. "Nor can the riders remain apart as they once did. There are too few of us to stand alone. And it will be a long while before there are again enough of us to resume our former place. In any event, you have already sworn yourself to Nasawada and to Oryk and Dorgrim Stingitum, but not to us, not to the Aelfakin. It is only right that we should have a rider and dragon as well.
You know that Saphira and I would fight for the elves as much as for the dwarves or the humans," he protested.
"I know, but others do not. Appearances matter, Aragorn. You cannot change the fact that you have given your word to Nasawada, and that you owe your loyalty to Oryk's clan. My people have suffered greatly over the past 100 years, and though it may not be apparent to you, we are not what we once were. As the fortunes of the dragons have declined, so too have our own. Fewer children have been born to us, and our strength has waned. Also, some have said that our minds are no longer as sharp as they used to be, although it is difficult to prove, one way or another.
The same is true of humans, or so Gleda told us, said Aragorn.
She nodded. He is right. Both of our races will take time to recover, and much will depend upon the return of the dragons. Moreover, even as Nasawada is needed to help guide the recovery of your race, so too do my own people need a leader. With Islanzadi dead, I felt obliged to take the task upon myself.
She touched her left shoulder, where her tattoo of the Yahweh glyph lay hidden.
I pledged myself to the service of my people when I was not much older than you. I cannot abandon them now, when their need is so great.
They will always have need of you.
And I will always answer their call, she replied. Do not worry. Fionn and I shall not ignore our duties as a dragon and rider. We will help you to patrol the land and settle what disputes we can, and wherever it seems best to raise the dragons, we shall visit and lend our assistance as often as we can, even if it be at the far southern end of the spine.
Her words troubled Aragorn, but he did his best to hide it. What she promised would not be possible if he and Saphira did as they had decided during the flight there. Although everything Arya had said helped confirm that the path they had chosen was the right one, he worried that it was a path that Arya and Fionn would be unable to follow. He bowed his head then, accepting Arya's decision to become queen, and her right to make it.
I know you won't neglect your responsibilities, he said. You never do.
He did not mean the statement unkindly. It was merely a statement of fact, and one for which he respected her.
And I understand why you did not contact us for so long. I probably would have done the same in your place.
She smiled again.
Thank you.
He motioned toward her sword. I take it Runan reworked Tamerlane to better fit you.
She did, and she grumbled about it the whole while. She said the blade was perfect the way it was, but I am well pleased with the changes she made. The sword balances as it should in my hand now, and it feels no heavier than a switch.
As they stood watching the dragons, Aragorn tried to think of a way to tell Arya of their plans. Before he could, she said,
You and Saphira have been well?
We have.
What else of interest has occurred since you wrote?
Aragorn thought for a minute, then told her in brief about the attempts on Nasawada's life, the uprisings in the north and the south, the birth of Roran and Katrina's daughter, Roran's ennoblement, and the list of treasures they had recovered from within the citadel. Lastly, he told her of their return to Carverhall, and their visit to Brom's final resting place. While he spoke, Saphira and Fionn began to circle each other, the tips of their tails whipping back and forth faster than ever. They both had their jaws slightly open, baring their long white teeth, and they were breathing thickly through their mouths and uttering low, whining grunts, the likes of which Aragorn had never heard before. It looked almost as if they were going to attack each other, which worried him. But the feeling from Saphira was not one of anger or fear, it was...
I want to test him, said Saphira.
She slapped her tail against the ground, causing Fionn to pause.
Test him? How? For what?
To find out if he has the iron in his bones and the fire in his belly to match me.
Are you sure?
He asked, understanding her intent. She again slapped her tail against the ground, and he felt her certainty and the strength of her desire.
I know everything about him. Everything but this. Besides,
she displayed a flash of amusement.
It's not as if dragons mate for life.
Very well, but be careful.
He had barely finished speaking when Saphira lunged forward and bit Fionn on his left flank, drawing blood and causing Fionn to snarl and spring backward. The green dragon growled, appearing uncertain of himself, and retreated before Sephira as she prowled toward him.
Sephira!
Chagrined, Aragorn turned to Arya, intending to apologize. Arya did not seem upset. To Fëanor, and to Aragorn as well, she said, If you want her to respect you, then you have to bite her in return. She raised an eyebrow at Aragorn, and he responded with a wry smile, understanding. Fëanor glanced at Arya and hesitated. He jumped back as Sephira snapped at him again. Then he roared and lifted his wings as if to make himself appear larger, and he charged Sephira and nipped her on a hind leg, sinking his teeth into her hide. The pain Sephira felt was not pain. Sephira and Fëanor resumed circling, growling and yowling with increasing volume. Then Fëanor jumped at her again. He landed on Sephira's neck and bore her head to the ground, where he held her pinned and gave her a pair of playful bites at the base of her skull. Sephira did not struggle as fiercely as Aragorn would have expected, and he guessed that she had allowed Fëanor to catch her, as it was not something even Thorn had managed to do. The courting of dragons is no gentle affair, he said to Arya.
Did you expect soft words and tender caresses?
I suppose not.
With a heave of her neck, Sephira threw Fëanor off and scrambled backward. She roared and clawed at the ground with her forefeet, and then Fëanor lifted his head toward the sky and loosed a rippling pennant of green fire twice the length of his own body.
Oh!
Exclaimed Arya, sounding delighted.
What? That's the first time he has breathed fire.
Sephira released a blast of fire herself. Aragorn could feel the heat from over 50 feet away. And then she crouched and jumped into the sky, climbing straight upward. Fëanor followed an instant later. Aragorn stood with Arya as they watched the glittering dragons ascend into the heavens, spiraling around each other with flames streaming from their mouths. It was an awe-inspiring sight, savage and beautiful and frightening. Aragorn realized he was watching an ancient and elemental ritual, one that was part of the very fabric of nature itself, and without which the land would wither and die. His connection with Sephira grew tenuous as the distance between them increased, but he could still sense the heat of her passion, which darkened the edges of her vision and blotted out all thoughts save those driven by the instinctual need that all creatures, even the elves, are subject to. The dragons shrank, until at last they were no more than a pair of sparkling stars orbiting each other in the immensity of the sky. As far away as they were, Aragorn still received a few flashes of thoughts and feelings from Sephira, and though he had experienced many such moments with the Eldonari when they had shared their memories with him, his cheeks grew hot, as did the tips of his ears, and he found himself unable to look directly at Arya. She, too, seemed affected by the dragon's emotions, although differently than he. She stared after Sephira and Fëanor with a faint smile, and her eyes shone brighter than usual, as if the sight of the two dragons filled her with pride and happiness. Aragorn let out a sigh, and then squatted and began to draw in the dirt with a stalk of grass. "Well, that didn't take long," he said.
"No,"
said Arya. They remained that way for a number of minutes, she standing, he squatting, and all silence around them, save for the sound of the lonely wind. At last, Aragorn dared look up at Arya. She looked more beautiful than ever, but more than that, he saw his friend and ally. He saw the woman who had helped save him from Durza, who had fought alongside him against countless enemies, who had been imprisoned with him under Dras Leona, and who in the end had killed Shrukan with the Dauthdert. He remembered what she had told him about her life in Ellesmere when she was growing up, her difficult relationship with her mother, and the many reasons that had driven her to leave De Weldenvarden and serve as an ambassador to the elves. He thought, too, of the hurts she had suffered, some from her mother, others from the isolation she had experienced among the humans and the dwarves, and still more when she had lost Faelin, and then endured Durza's tortures in Gilead. all those things he thought of, and he felt a deep sense of connection with her, and a sadness too, and a sudden desire came upon him to capture what he saw. While Arya meditated upon the sky, Aragorn looked about until he found a piece of the slate-like rock projecting from the earth. Making as little noise as possible, he dug out a slab with his fingers and brushed off the dirt until the stone was clean. It took him a moment to remember the spells he had once used, and then to modify them so as to extract the colors needed from the earth around him. Speaking the words silently, he incanted the spell. A stir of motion, like a swirl of muddy water, disturbed the surface of the tablet. Then colors, red, blue, green, yellow, bloomed on the slate, and began to form lines and shapes, even as they intermingled to form other, subtler shades. After a few seconds, an image of Arya appeared. Once it was complete, he released the spell and studied the Firth. He was pleased with what he saw. The image seemed to be a true and honest representation of Arya, unlike the Firth he had made of her in Ellesmere. The one he held now had a depth that the other one had lacked. It was not a perfect image with regard to its composition, but he was proud that he had been able to capture so much of her character. In that one image, he had managed to sum up everything he knew about her, both the dark and the light. He allowed himself to enjoy his sense of accomplishment for a moment more, then he threw the tablet off to the side to break it against the ground.
"Kalster," said Arya,
and the tablet curved through the air and landed in her hand. Aragorn opened his mouth, intending to explain or to apologize, but then he thought better of it and said nothing. Holding up the Firth, Arya stared at it with an intent gaze. Aragorn watched her closely, wondering how she would react. A long, tense minute passed. Then Arya lowered the Firth. Aragorn stood and held out his hand for the tablet, but she made no move to return it. She appeared troubled, and his heart sank. The Firth had upset her. Looking him straight in the eye, she said in the ancient language,
"Aragorn, if you are willing, I would like to tell you my true name." Her offer left him dumbstruck. He nodded, overwhelmed, and with great difficulty managed to say, "I would be honored to hear it."
Arya stepped forward and placed her lips close to his ear, and in a barely audible whisper, she told him her name. As she spoke, the name rang within his mind, and with it came a rush of understanding. Some of the name he knew already, but there were many parts that surprised him, parts that he realized must have been difficult for Arya to share. Then Arya stepped back and waited for his response, her expression studiously blank. Her name raised numerous questions for Aragorn, but he knew that it was not the time to ask them. Rather, he needed to reassure Arya that he did not think any less highly of her because of what he had learned. Nor did he. If anything, her name had increased his regard, for it had shown him the true extent of her selflessness and her devotion to duty. He knew that if he reacted badly to her name, or even said the wrong thing without intending to, he could destroy their friendship. He met Arya's gaze full on, and said, also in the ancient language,
Your name is a good name. You should be proud of what you are. Thank you for sharing it with me. I am glad to call you my friend, and I promise that I will always keep your name safe. Will you, now, hear mine?"
She nodded.
"I will, and I promise to remember and protect it, for so long as it remains yours."
A sense of import came over Aragorn. He knew there was no going back from what he was about to do, which he found both frightening and exhilarating. He moved forward and did as Arya had done, placing his lips by her ear and whispering his name as softly as he could. His whole being vibrated in recognition of the words. He backed away, suddenly apprehensive. How would she judge him?
fair or foul, for judge him she would. She could not help it.
Arya released a long breath and looked at the sky for a while. When she turned to him again, her expression was softer than before.
"You have a good name as well, Aragorn," she said in a low voice. "However, I do not think it is the name you had when you left Palancar Valley."
"No.
Nor do I think it is the name you bore during your time in Ellesmere. You have grown much since we first met."
"I've had to." She nodded.
"You are still young, but you are no longer a child."
"No, that I am not." More than ever, Aragorn felt drawn to her. The exchange of names had formed a bond between them, but of what sort he was unsure, and his uncertainty left him with a sense of vulnerability. She had seen him with all his flaws, and she had not recoiled, but had accepted him as he was, even as he accepted her. Moreover, she had seen in his name the depth of his feelings for her, and that too had not driven her away. He debated whether to say anything on the subject, but he could not let it go. After gathering up his courage, he said,
"Arya, what is to become of us?"
She hesitated, but he could see that his meaning was clear to her. Choosing her words with care, she said,
"I don't know. Once, as you know, I would have said nothing. But, again, you are still young, and humans often change their minds. In 10 years or even 5, you may no longer feel as you now do."
"My feelings won't change," he said with utter certainty. She searched his face for a long, tense while. Then he saw a change in her eyes, and she said,
"If they don't, then perhaps in time."
She put a hand on the side of his jaw.
"You cannot ask more of me now. I do not want to make a mistake with you, Aragorn. You are too important for that, both to me and to the whole of Alagaesia."
He tried to smile, but it came out more as a grimace.
"But we don't have time," he said.
His voice choked. He felt sick to his stomach. Arya's brow furrowed, and she lowered her hand.
"What do you mean?"
He stared at the ground, trying to think how to tell her. In the end, he just said it as simply as he could. He explained the difficulty he and Saphira had had in finding a safe place for the eggs and the Eldunari. And then he explained Nasawada's plan to form a group of magicians to keep watch over every human spellcaster. He spent several minutes talking, and concluded by saying,
"So Saphira and I have decided that the only thing we can do is leave Alagaesia and raise the dragons elsewhere, far away from other people. It's what's best for us, for the dragons, for the riders, and all the other races of Alagaesia."
"But the Eldunari," said Arya, appearing shocked.
"The Eldunari can't stay either. They would never be safe, not even in Ellesmere. As long as they remain in this land, there will be those who will try to steal them or use them to further their own designs. No, we need a place like Vroengard, a place where no one can find the dragons to hurt them, and where the younglings and the wild dragons cannot hurt anyone themselves."
Aragorn tried to smile again, but gave it up as hopeless.
"That is why I said we have no time. Saphira and I intend to leave as soon as we can. And if you stay, I do not know if we will ever see each other again."
Arya glanced down at the faerth she still held, troubled.
"Would you give up your crown to come with us?"
he asked, already knowing the answer. She lifted her gaze.
"Would you give up charge of the eggs?"
He shook his head.
"No."
For a time they were silent, listening to the wind.
"How would you find candidates for the riders?" she asked.
"We'll leave a few eggs behind, with you, I suppose. And once they hatch, they and their riders will come join us, and we'll send you more eggs."
"There must be another solution, besides you and Sephira and every Eldunari, abandoning Alagazia. If there were, we would take it. But there isn't. What of the Eldunari? What of Gleda and Umaroth? Have you spoken to them of this? Do they agree? We haven't spoken to them. But they will agree. That I know. Are you sure about this, Aragorn? Is it really the only way? To leave behind everything and everyone you have ever known? It's necessary, and our departure was always meant to be. Angela foretold it when she cast my fortune in Tirm, and I've had time to accustom myself to the idea. He reached out and touched Arya on the cheek. So, I ask again, will you come with us? A film of tears appeared on her eyes, and she hugged the Faerth against her chest. I cannot. He nodded, and took his hand away. Then we will part ways. Tears welled in his own eyes, and he struggled to retain his composure. But not yet, she whispered. We still have some time together. You will not leave immediately. No, not immediately. And they stood next to each other, gazing into the sky, and waiting for Sephira and Fionnan to return. After a while, her hand touched his, and he grasped it. And though it was a small comfort, it helped dull the ache in his heart.
A Man of Conscience. Warm light streamed through the windows along the right of the hallway, illuminating patches of the far wall, where banners, paintings, shields, swords, and the heads of various stags hung between the dark, carved doors that dotted the wall at regular intervals. As Aragorn strode toward Nasawada's study, he gazed out the windows at the city. From the courtyard, he could still hear the bards and musicians performing by the banquet tables laid out in Arya's honor. The celebrations had been ongoing since she and Fionnan had returned to Illyria with him and Sephira the previous day. But now they were beginning to wind down, and as a result, he had finally been able to arrange a meeting with Nasawada. He nodded to the guards outside the study, then let himself into the room. Inside, he saw Nasawada reclined on a padded seat, listening to a musician strumming on a lute and singing a beautiful, if mournful, love song. On the end of the seat sat the witch-child Elva, engrossed with a piece of embroidery, and in a nearby chair, Nasawada's handmaid Ferica. And curled up on Ferica's lap lay the weercat Yellow-Eyes in his animal form. He looked sound asleep, but Aragorn knew from experience that he was probably awake. Aragorn waited by the door until the musician finished.
"Thank you. You may go," said Nasawada to the player. "Ah, Aragorn. Welcome."
He bowed slightly to her. Then to the girl, he said, "Elva?" She eyed him from under her brow.
"Aragorn?" The weercat's tail twitched. "What is it you wish to discuss?" asked Nasawada.
She took a sip from a chalice resting on a side table.
"Perhaps we could speak in private," said Aragorn, and motioned with his head toward the glass-paneled doors behind her, which opened onto a balcony overlooking a quadrangle with a garden and fountain. Nasawada considered for a moment, then rose from her seat and swept toward the balcony, the train of her purple dress trailing behind her. Aragorn followed, and they stood side by side, gazing at the spouting water of the fountain, cool and grey within the shadow cast by the side of the building.
"What a beautiful afternoon," said Nasawada as she took a deep breath. She looked more at peace than when he had last seen her, only a few hours before.
"The music seems to have put you in a good mood," he observed.
"No, not the music. Elva."
He cocked his head.
"How so?"
A strange half-smile graced Nasawada's face.
"After my imprisonment in Urubain, after what I endured and lost, and after the attempts on my life, the world seemed to lose all colour